Okay, yeah, but so this is, yeah, what can I talk about? So I assume everybody knows about contrast invariance of tuning, so that I don't have to explain this. And everybody also knows about.
Explain.
Okay, I will very briefly. Simple cells in V1, everybody knows that. If you look at the response of the cells to a bar, they have a preferred orientation at which they fire at a higher rate than at other orientations. So typically, with some contrast, the output of a cell will be something like this, where, okay, so in the published data, all the neurons in the published data have a half widths of half max of about 30 degrees. Neurons in V1, this varies from about 30 degrees to 60, 80 degrees. Now, if you, so you can look at sort of the tuning of this of these cells by looking at a fixed contrast. You look at the response. You count the number of spikes. For different orientations, then you change the, then you increase the contrast. You do the same thing, and lo and behold, the neurons fire with a higher firing rate. But the shape of this curve, so the curve will now something like this, but the shape of the curve will be roughly the same. So if you normalize, then you'd get if you normalize with respect to peak, you get two curves which are within experimental error coincide. Now there's been a big debate over the last decades on trying to explain this fact. And so basically the problem is that it's easy to imagine that the input in the neurons will be contrast invariant. So if you look at.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Can I ask you to make one more plot, just so that I completely understand? Can you plot the firing rate as a function of the contrast for a fixed angle?
Okay, yeah, sure. That should be. Okay, so we have contrast here. Rate. Typically, you'd get something which is. Sort of like this, it saturates at some point.
Okay, now when people talk about contrast invariant, which range of contrasts are they thinking about?
Okay, so they're thinking about the whole range of contrasts, actually.
But at saturation.
Okay, so this is the thing, right? So this would be the tuning curve for, let's say, the optimal orientation. If you take a different orientation, let's say here, of course you get a higher, you get a lower rate, but so what you get is something which looks more or less like this. So it's not just that it grows slower and then also reaches the saturation point.
So the saturation is different for different.
Yes, exactly. Saturation is different for different orientations.
Carl, when you talk about art, you're talking really about usually the neural response either to a flashing bar or a moving bar. So what with respect to dynamics? Do you take all the number of spikes after the, let's say, for flashing bar, after the flashing, or you look at a certain window?
Okay, so if you look at certain window, that doesn't make too much difference. Usually, when with flashing bars, people look at all the spikes over a fairly long period, just to get
There is no difference between the beginning of the phenomena,
No, not
or
really.
anything.
One of the problems here is that to get good statistics, right, in these animals which you're working with, they have a finite half-life. So one thing, for example, that people often do with when you have moving gratings, right? So they look at the tuning both of the mean response and also of the first harmonic. Right, so, and you see that both of them are have contrast invariant tuning.
And you have the same curves for both.
Yeah, so you have the same curve both for the mean response and for the modulation. Yeah.
Carl, yep. So does that hold for complex cells?
This also holds for complex
cells.
You said
simple cells when you were good.
Well, yes. So the simple cells, well, basically, the simple cells are the first ones for which they measured this in 82. So it's fairly well established by now that these things happen. Okay, so why is this a problem? So you can, it's fairly easy to imagine that the inputs into the cells is contrast invariant. Especially for complex cells, it gets presumably get the input from simple cells. So simple cells have contrast invariant output, so you'd expect complex cells to have contrast invariant input, right? So you have an input which input which is sort of like this for one contrast, and for a second contrast, you'd get something which is just larger than this. So now comes the problem, namely all of these neurons have a threshold. Right, so below thresholds, supposedly they don't fire. Above threshold, they do fire. So if I put in a threshold here, I get that for the low contrast, you get only a response between here and here. Whereas for the high contrast, I would expect a response between here and here. So if you increase the contrast, you increase the angle over which you expect a response. Okay, so this is the so-called iceberg effect, and people have tried very hard to explain it away. And one of the and the experimentalists basically have come up with explanations which try to keep everything sort of a feed-forward network, which explains why you don't have this contrast with this iceberg effect problem. And the theorists typically favor solutions where the feedback is the dominant part. So in all these cases, what you'd get is instead of having an input which is contrast invariant, you'd get an input which, if you'd have a higher contrast input, which would be something which goes like this. So it's no longer, the input is no longer contrast invariant, but the input after thresholding is contrast invariant. This is sort of more or less what all the models up to very recently have come up with. In the group of Fester, they were actually able to measure the, so they, in the group of Fester recently in a science paper in December 2000, they actually measured the mean voltage of the neurons and looked at their contrast dependence, and here, for example, for simple cells, and here for complex cells. So here for the simple cells, they looked at the tuning of the voltage as a function of angle. So here is the mean voltage for three different contrasts, and here is the normalized the normalized response of the voltage, and here do the same thing for the voltage modulation, and then we also at the same time look at the tuning of the firing rate of the neurons.
You can call the voltage of the neuron input. The voltage of the neuron is really the output. It's not the current of the neuron.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's you should not blame me for what Fashton did. Okay, so
the output is the firing and the membrane voltage is the
Membrane voltage. Okay, so right. So this is one problem I also have with the paper, and David is right. The voltage is not the input. The input are the input is the synaptic input, and the input results. EPSCs are the input, and they result in. A change in voltage and a result in spikes, right? So, but okay. So basically, what in the whole Förster paper, sort of the assumption of the Förster paper is essentially that the neuron is a passive integrator with spikes. So, if it's just a passive integrator, then you can relate the input currents directly to the voltage.
Yes, but even then, you have to do kind of the convolution. Because
okay, but if you're just looking at the mean voltage, you're just looking at the average voltage, and you look at the contrast dependence of the first harmonic. I mean, one of the things they don't do is it change the frequency with which these things oscillate, right? So okay, you'd have to do some convolution, but this convolution will always be the same. So this will not be. So that's not something that should be contrast dependent. Of course, if you would have put in an input which has a different frequency, then the amplitudes of the modulated part might be different. But okay, so that's not something they checked, right? So.
Yes, tennis was drifting, really.
The stimulus was drifting grating. Yeah. So the drifting sign also are all grating. And,
what's the difference between C and G?
That's a good question. Which? Okay, C is the average voltage, so that's time averaged, and D is the modulation of the voltage.
There are no firing rate.
These are all voltages. So these two are voltages. This is firing rate. Right? So if you look at the normalized ones, you see that. Okay, so this is also a typical Förster trick.
So how do you measure if you disregard the spikes?
Well, you have your intracellular recording. You can see the spikes, right? So you get.
Then when you
average, when you do the average, yes. So they cut. So when they calculate the average voltage, they cut at threshold. Yeah.
So only sub-threshold voltage.
Yeah. It turns out it doesn't make too much difference in this case. I mean, definitely not here, because you see the firing rate doesn't go higher than, okay, here it says 8. Right, so
why this?
These are, this is something from the Förster lab. They always have very low firing rates.
So you call it a
Förster
trick?
It's, well, yeah, and so that's a question whether it's a trick or it's something which is a problem of their, or which is particular to how they do things in their lab.
Is it due to the difference between
the intracellular and extracellular? No, it doesn't, that's not the difference. I talked to Lauro Graham, who's also doing intracellular, and he has no problem in finding cells which go off with the best contrast, that go off with a frequency of 40 to 60 hertz. So the original SCLAR data, which showed the contrast invariance, they had neurons which went up to 80 hertz. So in the sort of disturbing in this Förster thing is that the highest maximum firing rate they find in all the data that they show is a neuron which goes off at about 20 hertz. So this is something which...
Is it an anesthetic issue, do people think, or just nobody knows?
I've asked several people, and nobody really seems to know what the differences are. But, okay, so let's for the moment just forget about all the possible problems with their data gathering. I'll come back to it when we discuss this in more detail. So one thing that also should also be noted, if you look at actually the voltage traces of the neurons, you see that these voltage traces have this gigantic amount of noise. Also, we've also indicated here sort of the threshold voltage. Also, these neurons, most of the time, they are below threshold. So they're below threshold, and because you have the noise every now and then, you get above threshold.
So there are many traces. These are different contrasts?
These are different contrasts, yeah. So the different contrasts, so these are three traces, actually. So those are the three contrasts that they show here. In the regime which they're looking at, this picture here doesn't really apply, because this picture sort of, so the standard idea is about the iceberg effect. You're talking about neurons which have an input. If there is a response, they have an input which with a mean which is above threshold, and there is no noise. So from these data, the first group argued.
Why the neuron fires at all at lower quantities? It seems to be so deep below threshold.
It's, well, yeah, but it also, so it's firing, but it's firing at a very low rate, right? So it's firing at a rate of 1 hertz. And this is only a couple.
Spontaneously, it doesn't fire at all.
Spontaneously, it fires at 0.1 hertz.
So this is a lot of statistics here.
Yes. So you need a lot of statistics to get this. And
Carl, yeah? If I just naively use the same transfer function that Nicholas wrote for the subthreshold interval where you have this square hyperbolic part, and I use that on the inputs, then I would have a problem with consciousness
invariance. Yeah. If you do use hyperbolic, yeah, you do.
I'm sorry.
You do. Okay.
No, the function is parabolic. Okay, I take parabolic. An offset and I square it, and if the input
very good.
Under the same invariance, then the algorithm will be.
You see, I should have given my talk before Nicholas.
Well, that's a
very
interesting.
Because that's more or less the solution, right? So, so this is, the first, then did also, the group did also did some simulations where they showed if you take a threshold linear neuron and you add sufficient amount of noise, then you do get, in simulations, you do get that if you contrast independent input, you get contrast independent output. And so, but the question really, so then the question is really is why, right? And Nicholas already sort of gave the answer, but I want to do it a bit more general now, right? So basically the model they looked at is a model where you have some firing rate, which is threshold linear function of the voltage. So we have rate, which is just a non-linear function of the voltage. So we use threshold linear, but I think it's good to when you start to think about this, to first think about this in more general terms. So now if you have a case where you have an input which is contrast invariant, but also has but you have also a lot of noise. Okay, so one of the things you should add is that if you look at the noise, so we also look at the tuning of the noise. If you look at the tuning of the noise, you find that the noise doesn't depend on the contrast and hardly depends also on the orientation of the input.
One question about this contrast independent input. You say it's easy to imagine how complex cells would get this. And for
Simple cells.
Also, is it
if you assume that the response of the LGN cells is, if you assume that that's linear with contrast, then you would easily get it. Or if all the neural, if all the SIMPA cells have the, all the LGN cells have the same, the tuning is the same shape with the input, then
you mean contrast tuning.
So if the only thing that changes if you change the contrast for the for those cells is just you change the prefactor, then you'd also have the same thing. Right, so in the first data, or in the first model, well, the data suggests that the fluctuations in the inputs are not really, don't depend on the stimulus at all. And that the mean response is contrast in the, has a contrast independent tuning. So you could take that this voltage would be some maximum voltage of contrast times So this you would write kappa, but you can use something else. So contrast independent tuning of the mean input basically means that you can write it as a product of something which depends only on the contrast and something which depends only on the angle. And so we have
AV doesn't depend on
V. It's this is just the tuning of the voltage. Right, so that's why it's because pretty soon we're also going to have something like this for the rate. Right, so plus then we have some noise term with a variance sigma, let's say Gaussian.
And you assume that this is the gain, the transfer function is sort of instantaneous.
And yes, so you assume that the transfer function is instantaneous. Right, so now if you plug this into this equation, then of course for the average rate will be some function of will be some function after averaging over the noise will be some function of the mean input. Right, so but now we also want to get that the.
Well, this depends on sigma as on the parameter.
Okay, so this depends on sigma exactly, right? But okay, so if we want to have also contrast independence of the output, then we want to be able to also write this rate as a product of a contrast and a rate dependent part. Right, so this should be. Right, so you could ask yourself, this noise average transferred function G sigma, are there solutions for this under which this is this works? Well,
where did sigma go in the last?
Right here.
No, no.
Okay. I have here some input with noise. Right, after averaging, this gives me some rate.
Well, it's crucial that you assume
that sigma is constant. Yes. It doesn't depend on
exactly.
C on
theta.
Yeah. I agree.
So it just
becomes
an index. Otherwise, you would have to put
it. Otherwise, you things become much more complicated. But this seems to be more or less warranted by the data. Okay, so
that's what you see from these traces.
That's they actually did do some analysis on it, which I should have also brought with me, but didn't bring. But you see that there is within the uncertainty of the measurements, you don't see any dependence on both contrast and angle.
So how could this be actually, it means that it's mostly coming from, not from MGM, and not from the local inputs, but from...
But from the rest of the brain, yeah. Yes, I think
it's
so.
It's strange, because most of the inputs are coming from local, populations.
So yes, no, I agree. It's, I mean, this is something which I don't understand how this works.
Oh, but it could come from other orientations.
But the other orientations, the input will also be contrast dependent, right? So you would think, so for all orientation, for cells of all orientations, you'd have some, if you increase the contrast, they'll all have higher firing rates. So, okay, some of them will be excitatory and some inhibitory, but you would expect, naively, if you look at the feedback you get from the network, that the fluctuations from that should scale with the contrast.
So they don't comment on this. They don't have
an explanation for it. And
the first who did these measurements?
Sorry?
They were the first who did
it. There have been scattered indications of it. But so they were really the first who did measurements where they looked systematically at the contrast and angular dependence. And I agree. So this is a big mystery where these things come from. Of course, in their model, they cannot say too much about it because they don't really have anything that says something about how the fluctuations in the input go into fluctuations of the voltage, because there is no dynamical model which relates the voltage to the synaptic inputs. So one of the things I want to show is that if we actually take a more realistic conductance-based neuron, we also have to assume that most of the feed of the inputs fluctuations are input fluctuations which come from, which are independent of the stimulus. So don't come from local feedback, etc. But to get back to the issue at hand here. So you have a rate which is some function of the mean voltage, where you can write the mean voltage as a product of contrast and angle-dependent part. Then you want to have a contrast-dependent independent output tuning. You want this rate also to be written as separate parts. An obvious function g which satisfies this is but g is just a linear function, right? So if g, exactly, right? So it's true for any power, and you can actually show straightforwardly that a power law is the only thing that does this.
The way I don't understand that, let's take the cubic, don't you get a mixture of terms?
No?
What?
In the cubic?
Cuban.
Okay, so g sigma v is a v to the power alpha. Let's do alpha so that we don't have to do it.
He gets rid of the sum before he does the function.
X, Y.
I'm talking about function g of v.
No, g sigma.
G sigma comes from averaging over g of e.
Exactly. I know.
So
but
functions g. I thought you were asking what function little g give you this.
No. I'm asking about the function big g.
Okay.
Because that's easy. To talk about the little g, that's much too difficult.
Okay.
Right. So. So we have to get that the big g should be some power law, right? Obviously, if you get this, you plug in this, you see that it works, right?
And this has to be true for all possible inputs.
Okay, so they're actually...
It's performed for the whole range.
You can actually do it, so sort of the right solution that you get S, the G sigma of F over V marginal zero. Okay, so we made one extra assumption that if the voltage goes to minus infinity, that the rate goes to zero, which seems like a reasonable assumption. And the other extra assumption, reasonable assumption is that if the rate goes, if the voltage goes to minus infinity, the rate goes to zero. Right, so if V is less than zero, the rate is zero.
No, you're saying minus infinity, but there's no minus infinity.
Why should this, there is no reason to say why this should not be minus.
There are numbers that are less than zero, but are not minus infinity.
Yeah. Okay, but in there, okay. So.
We accept that at minus infinity the rate is zero, but we find it much more puzzling that at V equals zero, the rate is zero.
Okay.
We don't talk about.
I mean, obviously, this is only the only correct solution you find for the noise which satisfies this. Obviously for this is hard to imagine with a noisy neuron, right? If you have a voltage which is zero and you have noise, you would expect a neuron to have a finite firing rate. This already suggests. So in other words that. Okay, you can easily get this, but it's hard to imagine that you have some function g, little g, which after averaging over the noise will give you something like this. I'll grant you that. So this suggests that this noise model will not work perfectly. Right, so if the noise model would for the noise model to work perfectly, we need to have that something like this happens, works. If this is exact, then contrast independent input will give you contrast independent output.
So even if the noise amplitude has a hard limit, wouldn't that
help? Yes, but then you can have a noise amplitude which has a hard limit, which is just a threshold form. I mean, we could probably cook up something totally unrealistic, but actually gives the right answer. But yeah.
You only want to get the right answer in some range of parameters. There's no right. I mean, contrast invariance only valid for some.
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
Parameters and for that range of parameters you can satisfy everything, but you don't need to have that.
Well, you can never satisfy everything, but you can satisfy a lot. Yeah.
Didn't you also say that simulations have worked pretty well with Jewish threshold
limit? Yes, I did.
So, I mean, that's.
Okay, yeah, so, this is very nice, it's very good, because the people come up with the questions which are just the thing I want to explain next, right, so, yes, so that this is the following, the step is now, let's look at threshold linear, right, so you have G of V is some beta times E minus, which is threshold linear function. And let's assume that this noise here actually is Gaussian. Then you can, of course, average over the Gaussian noise, and you'll get that G sigma of V is. Okay, I'm now going to do this by heart, so I'll probably get it wrong, but. Plus. which is in the results section, right? So.
Looks right. I'm missing right parentheses. That's a mistake, I think.
Huh?
You're missing right parentheses.
I'm not ready yet.
Okay. There, now it's
where h of x is the complementary area of a function sensibly defined. Okay, so you might say, okay, we failed because this obviously doesn't satisfy this.
But it's close to Drescher-Linger apart from the noise.
Huh?
This big G is now close to Drescher-Linger apart from the noise.
Exactly, and in fact, if you take the limit sigma goes to zero, this goes back to this. So that's reassuring, we didn't make a mistake. So the interesting should we want to see is this close to this?
Well, of course, if Vt is 0 and sigma is 0, we want a linear function.
Yes, but Vt is not 0. I mean, if Vt is 0, then you didn't have the problem with the Eisberg effect to begin with, right?
And similarly, if sigma is 0,
if sigma is 0, you still have a problem because the Vt is not 0, so you have to. You have back the Eisberg effect. But
you have the problem with the Eisberg effect, but you don't have a problem of how to write Vg.
No, because it's V, it's not V minus Vt, right? So
if you insist on the small g being like that.
Yeah. Okay. The thing to see is, so what we'd like to see is there...
Can you go back by fixing G big to find out what's G
small? If you assume that this is Gaussian, so you have to deconvolve. So you get something which is going to be wrong because you get a G here for some voltage is going to be negative.
Yeah.
Right, and it would be nice to have extra positive weights.
The optimum G small, which is as close as
Probably, yeah.
In fact, it's the uncertainty of whether sigma is really invariant. Much larger than what we just was a mathematical problem.
Yeah. You can find some optimal, but instead I want to look at is this going to be going from here to here if for reasonable values of sigma are you going to get something which is optimal or not? But so
you want to work with this formula?
I want to go first with this formula and see what happens, right? But so first, actually, from the data here, one thing you can see if you look at the normalized version here is that the voltage tuning has a much broader tuning than the rate, right? And it's a factor of approximately 2. So this suggests that we have something which, if you have actually something like this, it suggests that this power alpha here should be larger than 1. Right? Because if alpha is 2, you'd actually get some, you get a tuning where the half width at half max narrows by a factor of square root of 2.
So this should be 4 then?
So this should be. I was wrong. Here the difference is actually a factor of 1.4. Right, so it's square root of 2. Right, so yeah. So here actually you get a pretty good fit if you take actually this in the paper they mentioned that if you take the fit of the tuning here, so you take a Gaussian fit here. And then they mentioned that if you take the fit here and take the fit here, then they're related with a power law, which seems to be somewhat trivial. But they mentioned that the power is approximately 2. So, so just, okay, so, so the test, they fit the tuning here with the power law, or with a Gaussian. They fit the tuning here with a Gaussian. Both Gaussians have the same preferred orientation. So you get two Gaussians around, and then they remark as something which is remarkable, that one is related, the one fit is related to the other fit with the power law.
But the issue is how the sequence changes by square root of 2. That's what the remark
on no, the... No, the yes, so the sigma, if sigma is the width of the Gaussian, yes. That's, so that's a different sigma than the noise.
No, sigma. I understand. But, okay. Yeah. Of this
okay, yeah. Yeah, so the width of the Gaussian is changed by a factor of almost the square root of 2.
But there aren't just two Gaussians, right? There is a pair of Gaussians for each contrast. So did they
yeah.
say that sigma changes by square root of 2 for every contrast?
No, but this
no and by the way, so you have your extra experimental uncertainty, right? So within the experimental uncertainty, they claim that these are all the same.
No, the Gaussian refers to the dependence on the angle.
Yeah.
No, but I'm still sort of...
Yeah, so you have...
If you assume contrast invariance, yes, yeah. But I'm still...
Yes, well, okay, but, I mean, they look the same and... the experimental data has a lot of noise, so you cannot really say whether or not they're the same, right? But they're sort of the same. And okay, let's get back to this function and see whether there is some range where you can approximate, where this will be well approximated by our law.
A square,
yes. But let's be less picky in the beginning and say by a power law. Right, so obviously the thing to do is to plot a log-log plot of rate and mean voltage. Right, so what you've done here. Now this is sort of easy to understand, but if your input is way above threshold, then the noise is not going to change too much. So above threshold, the thing should be, they should be linearly related. And, okay, you also get here that...
So what are the different curves?
Okay, so different levels, of sigma, different noise sigma.
Big G sigma?
Big G, yes. So this is big G.
So
it's the firing rate.
G, somewhere there is a threshold here.
The threshold is 1.
But it says in millivolts. So.
No, sorry. The threshold was 15 millivolts. So.
Okay, somewhere
here. You want 5 millivolts? I use the same.
So it's just when it starts to be small.
Yeah, so the slope is 1. There, you're above threshold, and so if you're sufficiently above threshold, then the noise doesn't really matter, right?
And do your neuron really fire in 100 kHz, or...?
Well, it's a threshold linear model. I didn't put in any saturation, I'm very sorry. Next time I will, but... Right, so of course, if you had no noise, right, so then by the time you reach the threshold, the thing should go to minus, the rate should go to 0, right, so it goes down. Now, of course, because you have some noise, even if the voltage, if the mean voltage is 0, you have finite rate. So you'd get, if you look at this curve here, should get some flat portion here or here or here, depending on the amount of noise you have. And so this curve, you should connect smoothly with this curve, so you go through an inflection point, right? So all these curves have an inflection point around which the rate you can approximate quite well by a straight line, which means there it's approximately a power law.
So there's over 5 orders of magnitude.
Well, for this one it's over 5 orders of magnitude. For this one it's quite, it's more like 2 orders of magnitude. But so this one is actually the one with the lowest noise. So the standard deviation of the noise fluctuations for this one was 1 millivolt. And you see that over about 5 orders of magnitude, you get that it fits quite well to the power law. But that doesn't really, it's not really all too useful because it starts to deviate from the power law by the time the voltage gets about 1/10 of a hertz, right? So between 10 to the minus 1/10, 0.1 hertz, right? At 1 hertz, this one doesn't really fit anymore, right? So you have to go to 0.1 hertz or 0.01 hertz. So between 10 to the minus 15 and 0.1, for very low rates it works, but and then it works beautifully for over at least 10 to the over 5 orders of magnitude. But that's
not for the rates you want.
But not for the rates you want. For this one, which has a standard deviation of 4 millivolts, it sort of, it works fine between, let's say, 0.1 hertz and about 10 hertz.
That's what you want.
And, yeah, so that's what you want, because the fact that below 0.1 hertz it doesn't fit too well, well, maybe that's not something you would stay awake and worry about. Okay, but still, 10 hertz is not too bad, not too high, right? So you could say, okay, I'll look at higher noise levels, like so here's standard deviation of 8 millivolts, and there it works up to about 30 hertz. But even with zero input, you get a rate of 1 hertz. Right, so the lower threshold, or the lower point where it doesn't work anymore, now becomes appreciable. So for this idea to work, you have to have something where the lower point should be sufficiently low, and the higher point, the highest point of the where the approximation still works, should be high enough. And so there you sort of have the, there you have the constraints, and obviously if your noise variation is too small, then you're in this range and it doesn't work because the maximum rate is not high enough. If it's too high, then it doesn't work because the minimum is not high enough. Furthermore, okay, this one, the more you increase the noise, the smaller the slope. Right, so you decrease the slope, and the amount of sharpening that you get from going from voltage to rate becomes less.
So can you tell us again what are the amplitudes for the three cases?
Okay. 1 millivolt, 4 millivolt, 8 millivolt.
What was measured?
And measured was 4.
So this is, you're talking about sigma?
Sigma, yes.
But sigma is not millivolts.
It is.
Now you don't have time scale here.
I mean, that's the thing, right? So you don't have time time scale here. So.
Yes, sigma is a limit, also time limit.
We have some. Yeah, but since this is an instantaneous function, right? It doesn't. Doesn't really.
No, I just
okay, so opa, right? So it's just a Gaussian and
with the unit variance.
With the unit variance, and you draw from this Gaussian. So you do just a lot of samples and you average. And you could, and because it's an instantaneous function, and you're only interested in the the average rate, it doesn't matter at all how, whether this is instantaneous or whether this is Gaussian white noise or a Gaussian with a long temporal correlation. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. So, what does this mean? So if now we look at a bunch of inputs and we look at sort of the response of the neuron, so for inputs which are a Gaussian with a fixed width, but which we change the maximum amplitude, which really means, which means change in the contrast. So for the sigma is 1k, you get something like this. And the Gaussian, for the input, the Gaussian was 30, has a width of 30 degrees. So you get incredible sharpening with a very low noise. But unfortunately, if you look at the normalized tuning curve, you see that so the low contrast tuning curves are very narrow, and the highest contrast ones are much broader. So you would not have contrast in variance.
What did you do here? You took some particular sigma.
So here I took. So I took some voltage. V was. V max e to the minus theta square. Where delta was 30 degrees. And so I changed V max. So I took V max from 3, 5, 10, 15 degrees. 50 millivolts, which
that's
and
some function of Z.
Okay, so the function of Z, I just took a couple of values of C,
yeah.
Right? So where, so, and since I didn't really specify what this function of Z is, right? Just take different values of the Vmax,
okay.
which would be different voltages, contrasts.
Okay.
Right.
Vmax of C, if you want.
Okay, Vmax of C, where this Vmax ranged from 3 millivolts to 15 millivolts, and 15 millivolts was also the threshold. So, basically, with this lowest noise, as already indicated also in the first previous graph, this doesn't work. Right, so now with the 4 millivolt, we get something which looks like this. So the rates, of course, are higher than previously because you have more noise, and the average was sub-threshold. You increase the noise, the firing rate goes up, and if you normalize, you see that this works approximately. I'm sure that experimentally you would you'd have a hard time distinguishing between the normalized tuning curves for these ones. Because if you go to 8 millivolts, you get the problem that at the off orientations, the rate is about 0.5 hertz. So if you normalize, since the lowest contrast, the maximum rate is about 5 hertz, so if you normalize the curves, then for the lowest contrast, the orientation at 90 degrees, or the strength at 90 degrees, the tuning will be 0.1. Whereas for the highest contrast, it will be 0. So here you get the differences now come in the tail. So if you have too much noise, then you get that it breaks down because the tails don't work anymore. Okay. Now, okay, so this was the rate model.
In some completely unrelated work, some years ago, we looking at data from Edmund, we got some estimate of this noise,
mm-hmm.
which is, the model was different. I don't want to tell you about that now, but it was an amplitude in hertz, not in millivolts.
Okay.
But however, the point that that strikes me in relation to your thing is that we got this amplitude that varied enormously from neuron.
From neuron. Uh-huh.
The neuron that we are looking at.
And this intracellular.
No, this was complicated thing extracted from the distribution of spike counts to some natural immunity. We'll talk about that some other time. But anyway, this amplitude of this noise that maybe we estimated in a very round way. But the only point I want to make that is it varied a lot from neuron to neuron.
From neuron to neuron, yeah.
From 10 hertz to 100 hertz, whatever that
means. Yeah.
So, but I just as a background mm-hmm. data to tell you that I'm not surprised by the fact that
I agree. It's very surprising, and
by the fact that
this noise doesn't depend on anything.
That noise should be rather tightly fixed.
It's tightly fixed. It's
not tightly fixed.
Yeah,
in fact, minus two.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. That's actually excellent. You see, I don't have to introduce anything here. It just gets said while I'm presenting things. So here I look for the different contrast. I look at the half width and half max as a function of the of sigma. Right. So if you have a roughly contrast independence, then the half width and half max should be the same for all contrast. Right. So the half width and half max of the input is here at is the same, so it's at 30, and for the different contrasts, of course, you always get the point if you so it's a function of the noise standard deviation sigma. So different curves are for different contrasts. So you have a you have a low of the weight response,
a different
contrast, right? So,
of the noise.
Yeah. So you have a low contrast solution. Low contrast, this one, intermediate contrast, and a high contrast.
So you want these three curves to be the same.
And you want these three curves to be the same, and so the only region where that works relatively well is around here. Which is
below 4.
So basically from 2 to 4, it works sort of okay. Now, here we have actually one of the things that experimentally is a bit of a difficulty, but contrast independence doesn't mean necessarily the same thing for all people. Right, so especially for the high rate case here, a lot of people, when they look at contrast independence, is what they do is they look at the tuning, they subtract the firing rate at the orthogonal orientation, and then they normalize. Right, so that so then of course by definition on the orthogonal you get things back to zero. So, if you do that for the high for the things with high noise, then you get that the normalized tuning curves look like this, and at the So 8 hertz, 8 millivolts, you still get something which works quite well. And particularly, also then, if you look at the half-fitted, half-max, then you get with a different contrast, you get tuning curves which look like this. And basically here you would get, if you look at the contrasting variance of the rate elevation rather than the raw rate, you get that for any voltage above or any standard noise deviation above 3-4 millivolts, it works fine. But of course, you don't, for 30 millivolts, 40 millivolts, you don't get any sharpening, but so basically then you have so much noise that, you know, that basically what you get is that the threshold becomes linearized, and you have some background rate, and all changes in voltage are reflected and changes in go linearly with the rate. Okay, so this is sort of how far you can, I'm sure you can go further with this model, but the whole model itself is not necessarily all that interesting, because you have a model where you relate sort of the voltage directly with the firing rate, and it doesn't really tell you all that much about the input. So you can do, you know, the analysis also with the integrated fire neuron. With the integrated fire neuron, where you assume that you have an input which is contrast independent, and then you can work out with
contrast
invariant. With contrast invariant tuning. Right, so input with contrast invariant tuning, you can, and on top of that, some Gaussian noise, which again we assume doesn't depend on the stimulus at all. Then you can calculate both the mean voltage, so you can calculate the mean voltage, the firing rate, as well as the fluctuations in the voltage. I don't have to write down the integrated fire neuron. I hope you all know it. Right, so if you look at the firing rate as function of the inputs, again, this is for the three different levels of noise. You get for low noise, you get, again, you get something which, of course, again, for very high inputs, you get something which has a slope of 1. For the low noise case, you get again something with a rate which is 1 or lower, at which you get a very nice power law. For intermediate noise, it's between 0.1 and 20, and again you can get some very high noise input. So obviously you would want to have some input where the noise is, if you have contrast independent input, you would have some noise where you're sort of along this curve. And you'd get that the tuning, this tuning thing works well between up to about 20, 30 hertz. Okay, in this case you get that the voltage is pretty much, below threshold is pretty much linear with the input, which is also not that difficult to understand. Essentially, as long as the input is not close to the threshold input, which is 1, as long as it's not close to the threshold input, basically the neuron doesn't fire, so the cell is just a passive integrator, and you're passively integrating some input with some noise, and you get to something, the mean of your input or of your voltage will be linear related with the mean of your input. It's only by the time when you start to get appreciable firing that the effect of reset becomes important, and if you have very high firing rate, again, you get essentially no effect of the voltage, of the fluctuations on the average voltage, because the neuron is basically constantly running around between resetting and going back to the threshold as fast as possible.
So what is that curve that is not monotonous?
Okay, so this is what's happening. So this is with the lowest noise. So what's happening is the neuron, if you have no noise at all, what will happen with this curve is that
I got it. Never goes to
the set. Okay. Exactly. So it never resets. So up until the threshold current, it's exactly linear, right? And then you get a low firing rate, and the neuron will get reset. So the voltage, when it starts to fire, the voltage actually average voltage is actually lower than just before it starts to fire, right? And then it continues to decrease and goes to halfway between the reset and the So this might not occur within conductance-based models, but for integrated and fire, because below threshold everything is exactly passive, you get automatically that within a reasonable range this is exactly linear. This need not be the case, obviously, in conductance-based neuron. And in conductance-based neuron, it's also highly unlikely that you actually get something which is non-monotonous, because you typically don't have this enormously strong reset which you have in integrated fire. So if you look at the standard deviation of the voltage noise, again, you get below threshold, the neuron is passively integrating some fluctuating inputs. The input has some Gaussian distribution, the output will have a Gaussian distribution, and this again only starts to change when the voltage, or when the neuron gets appreciable amount of spiking. So if you have, for example, if you have very low input fluctuations, you also get very low output fluctuations, and these go up to almost 1 nanoampere. At this point, the neuron starts to spike appreciably, and the voltage now will be more distributed between reset and threshold voltage, so the fluctuations in voltage suddenly go up quite a lot, and eventually you go to saturation level again. Interestingly, if the input has very large fluctuations, if the input is very much below threshold, then the fluctuations are actually larger than when the cell is firing. And basically that is because if you have a positive input, this will drive the voltage of the cell towards the threshold, but it will never be able to get above threshold. So even though you have high noise, if you drive the neuron hard enough, the voltage will essentially always be between reset and threshold. So you get to some value here. Again, the same. For the intermediate noise level, see that the fluctuations in voltage were very close to 4 millivolts, so basically up to close to the threshold. So here you actually get that it will first decrease and then increase somewhat. So here we get, if we look at the rate as a function of, the firing rate as a function of angle for different maximum input currents.
Essentially one thing you're telling us is that the magic number 4 is just the
mean excursion from reset to threshold. It's essentially what you get also when it fires.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's not. That's not really. That's not really. I wouldn't say that because remember that in the first data, the neurons were firing at a very low rate, right? So even the highest neuron that they had was one that went off at 20 hertz. So, which means that essentially we're always sort of in a regime which goes all sort of up to an input which is roughly here. So this part of the curve is not something that they are assessing in their data or in the data or in their experiments. So
no, but that actually it strengthens your point in the sense that if you measure the noise in terms of a voltage, it cannot be too far off the excursion from
the set. Yes, exactly, right. So I think that it would be very useful to actually, so our interpretation of their experiment, their explanation would be that if you find neurons which fire at significantly higher rates, you should start to see significant deviations from what they find. So for the so here we go to sort of within the regime where things work relatively well. So here we in the integrating fire we find that so for the firing rate you can get up to about 40 hertz for the maximum firing rate, and if you look at the normalized it works quite well. But if you look at the highest firing rate here, you look at the voltage, things become bad. Right, so the low voltage, the low contrast curves, you get this, okay, still this nice Gaussian because you're in the regime where the input is linear with the output. But the 40, the highest contrast, the one where it went up to 40 hertz, you got significant effects of the firing of the cell, which flattens the voltage tuning significantly around threshold. So if you normalize, you get something where you get serious deviations. So you should get something where if you go to 40 hertz or even higher, you should start to see that the voltage tuning, even if the rate tuning is still contrast invariant, the voltage tuning should no longer be contrast invariant.
The only people who measure voltage tuning is first just
Yeah, so the only people that have up to now been able to measure this voltage tuning were the people in Förster's lab, and they, for reasons that nobody seems to really understand, never measure neurons that go above 20 hertz. And okay, so if you look at the tuning of the voltage noise, you see that okay, there is some wobble for the highest contrast, but so these fluctuations are hard to measure. So experimentally, it's not clear that you'd actually say that this is significant. Would be significant differences. Actually, the differences here are larger than what you sort of see in the first data. Okay, now let me quickly also look at so this is basically all you can do analytically, but you can of course play with the model. So if you look at so we also did some simulations on a model with a conductance based model with the sort of extended Van Buzhaki model with persistent sodium cones, etc., etc., to sort of mimic pyramidal cells in V1, and so there you get, if you look at the output rate as a function of the input rate, you get for different noise levels. So, okay, so we took a neuron which has input, which is the feed for the LGN input is modeled as Poisson spike trains, which again have a tuning, which is, has a Gaussian profile in the angle, and but on to get fluctuations in the input which are reasonable, we also had to add extra Gaussian noise with a mean, with a zero mean into the cell, and so we tuned that basically to get the voltage fluctuations, which were about 4 millivolts, and which is sort of the intermediate value. But here we look at the firing rate as a function, or the output rate as a function of the input rate, also for input noise, which is lower. So again, you get in a log plot a region where it's much steeper. You get some intermediate region, and for some higher noise, you get something which is quite a bit flatter. So again, and it turns out that with the 4 millivolt, we get something with the 4 millivolt fluctuations. You'd get a nice straight line here, which works reasonably well up to 30 hertz. This one. So this is the input. So here we get sort of the conductance, the change in the neuron's conductance as a function of the angle, and so this is just a nice Gaussian. Note that we have assumed here that apart from the contrast-dependent, the stimulus-dependent input, there is also a small input which is contrast-independent, which has a mean which is not zero, and this actually turns out to make the region over which the contrast independence works, turns out to make the region over which it works much larger, which is not why we put it in initially. We put it in because we sort of got some reasonable numbers out of the literature, and we have contrast independent input into the cells.
But still tuned.
Also untuned. So the stimulus, so just a stimulus-independent background input into the cell, and on top of that we had the contrast, we had the stimulus-dependent Gaussianly tuned input. So this background input, we did the simulations with the background input, which sort of picked out of the literature as being sort of a reasonable number. So then we started writing the paper, and we realized, this is not really fair. In all the other examples, we do something without any input, without any contrast-independent input, and now we do this model and put this input. That's going to confuse people. Let's take it out. So we took it out. We tried again, and the whole thing works much. It's much worse. So then we put it back in. And okay, we could spend another half hour at least explaining why it works better, but let's not do it. But this sort of suggests that, I mean, this input into the cells So this might suggest some reason why there is, in the real world also, this contrasting dependent input into the cells.
So the external, I mean, all this non-CMS dependent input would possibly just give you this noise to independent everything.
So we have this input, but on top of that, we also have added extra Gaussian noise, right? Now you could say that this contrast-independent input is really an input which consists of both excitatory and inhibitory inputs, and the noise reflects the sum of the both, and the relatively small mean reflects just the difference of the two, but that doesn't really work on the for the conductance. Anyway, so if we look at sort of the voltage traces for these neurons, this was with a high contrast input at the preferred orientation and at the null orientation. So then to do simulations, we... Thank you. Yeah, I agree. It's very much like the experiment. In fact, I should just have said that this was experimental data. So then we sort of...
So what accounts for non-equal height of the spikes in the
model? Part of it is sampling. And these spikes are very fast spikes, right? So they go over the top. A part of it is also the amount of, there is a persistent, sodium channels here. So if you have if you recently had a spike, some of the sodium channels will be inactivated, and that decreases the height of the next spike. For the calculation of the mean voltage and for the voltage fluctuations, we clipped at sort of what turned out to be more or less the threshold voltage. And for the mean, to get the tuning of the mean voltage, it turned out that where precisely you clip, where you put this dotted line here, if you put it a millivolt higher or lower, doesn't really make any difference. Or a few, you could change by 5 millivolts, and you basically didn't see any difference. Of course, for the fluctuations in the voltage, it was quite. This became quite sensitive to the tuning. So in our best guess of what the threshold was, we get the tuning, which, it's weakly dependent on the contrast and on the angle. So the highest contrast we can go from, a little over 3 to about 4 millivolts, so we get a change of 30%, or slightly less. And for lower contrast, it's almost independent of the contrast. Now the voltage tuning works fine, and so does the tuning of the firing rate. And again, the firing rate has much narrower tuning than the voltage. And also here we get a factor of approximately the square root of 2 in the sharpening. But of course, so this factor of square root of 2 depends enormously on the precise values you take for the maximum conductances for the sodium and potassium channels, basically, and the noise level. Basically, it depends on the ratio between the noise and the noise level and the threshold voltage relative to rest seems to be the case. So the fact that we get sort of the same thing here as in the data, that doesn't really mean too much. But playing around with the variables and still have something which is biologically, I would say, equally reasonable, you can go from a factor of 1/2 to 0.8, 0.9 in the sharpening. But it's within biological range. And so then we get something which should be also easy to check experimentally, that if you look at sort of with these inputs, you look at the mean voltage of the cell and the mean firing rate of the cell. Since in this case both of them were a power law of the input, you get that the voltage is also a power law of the firing rate. And so here, these little dots here are the experimentally, or the values we got from the simulation, and the straight line is indeed a power law with of V plus 68 millivolts to the power 1.9, I believe. But we get a fairly good power law tuning. So this actually we've been trying to persuade some experimentalists to take a neuron, give it some noisy inputs, and measure mean voltage and the firing rate, and see whether you indeed get the power law. So
isn't there a go like this?
It's more or less in the first paper, but it's and the data is more or less all over the place. I mean, there's a lot of noise in the data, and you can fit it with a power law, but you could also fit it with somebody else, with an exponential or something, and it would look equally persuasive. It would be nice to have to find somebody who did something like this and really try to work very hard to get good statistics on. So in particular, you would like to get good statistics at the sort of low rates as well as the higher rates. The higher rates statistics is usually not such a big problem. Experimentally, people will sort of, for obvious reasons, shy away from stimulations where the rates are very low. Right. So a lot of experiments where you do have in vivo recording, there's quite a lot of data about sort of this region, but there's hardly any data about this region. So for the low inputs, this you cannot really check all that well whether this power law holds. So for these relatively low maximum firing rates, it seems that this adding noise is sufficient to get rid of the iceberg effect. And but again, it should be, I think, emphasized that this works. I mean, after working very hard, we could make this work up to 40 hertz. But beyond 40 hertz, it's basically a maximum firing rate of 40 hertz. If this were the mechanism for contrast invariance, it should start to break down. Now, the sort of the old data on contrast invariance suggests that suggest quite strongly that it doesn't break down for higher contrasts for larger outputs, which suggests, at least to me, that for neurons that are firing vigorously, that the network feedback has still a major role to play in keeping the neuronal response contrast invariance. The feedforward input just wouldn't do it.